Okay, well, welcome everyone. So today we're looking at the ideas in the book Love and Law around demonstrating from invisible principles. And if you think about life, that's everything. Because everything in this room started with an invisible idea. And from that comes creation. But what I think Ernest is actually asking us is, what are we willing to believe? Because that really determines a lot of what we can experience. And I always ask people, well, what's your worldview? What do you think of the world? Do you think the world is a, you know, really wonderful, kind, joyous, compassionate place, or is it a cruel world? You know, you always hear about the cruel world. And a lot of those, the world views, come from so many influences in our lives, our parents, our society, you know, everything we're exposed to, our own experiences. We have an experience and we think, okay, that means this, that dictates this, so that's the way it is because I've experienced it, so that must be true. And yet it's so much more fluid than that. And once people realize that, wow, you know, it's just like anything is possible. So it's good to remember, you know, that even though you've experienced something, that doesn't mean it's set in stone that it'll always be that way. So Abraham Hicks says, invisible thoughts turn into things because the momentum gets strong enough that they become a reality. So that's the premise, you know, of science of mind, that we're looking at what we're thinking, we're focusing our thoughts on what we want, and if we build that momentum, it becomes our reality. When I was preparing for this talk, I have a favorite new podcast called Hidden Brain with Sharker Vedantam. And a few weeks ago, he was interviewing a mathematician and a philosopher, Kaylin O'Connor. And she wrote a book that talks about how information spreads through social networks. And this is how we create beliefs. Is when information spreads through social networks. And so, you know, there's a lot of information that spreads through social networks, but we don't always believe it. So it's an exploration of, you know, well, how does that work, and how do we decide, you know, who we believe? And she gave a lot of examples from science, which I think is really actually appropriate because science of mind is a science. And so, for example, Aristotle believed that things fell to the earth because they were trying to go to their natural position in the center of the earth, because everything is made of earth substance. So it was like going home. It falls because it's going home. Newton believed that things fall to the earth because there's this force of gravity between any two massive objects which pull them together. So that was so that was an evolution in thought from Aristotle to Newton. Then Einstein comes along and has a theory of general relativity. And what he found is that we're all in a curved time-space, and when something falls to Earth, it's moving along a natural trajectory in that curved time space. Now, I looked up that theory for dummies, and I still don't get it, really. I mean, I kind of understand it, but it's a little over my head. But anyway, that is the current truth that science is using for its new interpretation of gravity. So that's one example of how thought as truth evolves. Another example was in 1716, Lady Mary Montague, who she was an English aristocrat that lived in Turkey with her husband, who was the ambassador. She got to know the Turkish women, and she was real fascinated with the culture. And she found out that, and this was during a time when smallpox was an issue in the world, and she found out that the Turkish women had figured out that if they took a little bit of pus from a pustule, somebody infected with smallpox, and they scratched the arm of, you know, somebody who hadn't had it yet, and just rubbed a little bit of that pus in that scratch, the person would get a real mild case of smallpox. Now, a few did die, but more people didn't die, and that was that. That's like what we do for vaccinations today. I mean, it's a earlier variation on it, but it worked, and so it was helping. It would build the immunity to smallpox. So she goes back to England, all excited about this, and tells doctors there. And did they believe her?
Probably not.
And so here's the social networking, why social networking fails to bring truth forward sometimes. Because we tend to believe people who are like us, or people are part of our community. So doctors believe doctors. Then you got the whole sexism thing, a man believing a woman. Then you've got the the fear of foreigners. So this is coming from a foreign country. We know nothing about this. This can't be right. So all of those social biases, or psychological biases, you could call them, got in the way of bringing this truth forward. Now, eventually, Mary went to somebody, higher up in the culture. She was part of the royal family, princess. I didn't write this down, but it was a princess, and got her to buy into it. And then the princess inoculated with this way both of her kids, and eventually, you know, it caught on with some people who were willing to believe the princess.
Wow.
Yeah. So, so a lot of times, you know, when we hear things, you know, we consider the source, which is a logical thing to do, and we're more apt to believe people that are like us, part of our community, part of our society. But what's interesting is when you think about scientists, you know, they're supposed to be objective. They're supposed to, you know, just give me the facts, just give me the research, and I'll make my decisions based on that. Mm-hmm. But the doctors that Mary first went to, they were not being true scientists. They were letting their psychological biases get in the way. Another example was in 2015 with Dr. Schimmelweis, who created the first obstetrics clinic in Vienna, where he was training new doctors and midwives. And so there was one clinic treating doctors, and then next door there was a clinic where midwives worked. And this doctor noticed that in his clinic with the doctors, there was a 10% mortality rate. And next door, with the midwives, it was only like a 3% mortality rate. And in his clinic, they were dying from something called child bed fever. I'm not sure what that is. But anyway, at some point, I mean, he was aware, you know, okay, something's going on here. And then they had a breakthrough when one of his colleagues scratched himself when he was conducting an autopsy and died from symptoms that looked a lot like that child bed fever. So what was happening in the doctor's clinic is they were also doing other procedures, and autopsies was one of them. Mm-hmm. And so doctors were doing autopsies, and then they would go directly from doing autopsies to delivering babies, because we didn't have the concept of bacteria then. So once he kind of was connecting the dots, he started asking all the doctors. I mean, it became a requirement to wash their hands in a chlorinated solution before they delivered babies. After he did that, the mortality rate dropped to 3%, the same as in the midwife clinic. So he's all excited, you know, he writes a paper and gets it published, and do his doctor friends believe him? No. They're insulted. They're offended. What? We have dirty hands? I mean, they're it's really interesting. So it took quite a while for that practice to catch on, but it did finally catch on. And today, you know, anybody going into surgery or anything like that, there's a long, you know, they're washing their hands for, I think it's a minute or longer, scrubbing up, you know, they call it, and they spend a lot of time at it. And then my last example comes from 1954 with Dr. Palmer, who was doing research on stomach ulcers. And at the time, there was a lot of there was an argument going on whether stomach ulcers were caused by acid in the stomach or by bacteria. And Palmer did research on 1,000 stomachs, and he didn't find bacteria. So they thought, well, that's conclusive evidence that ulcers are not caused by bacteria. Well, then in 1981, Dr. Barry Marshall comes along. Well, and let me go back a minute. So when everybody accepted Palmer's research, they just quit doing follow-up research on the bacteria. They said, okay, we've got it figured out. It's acid. Well, then in 1981, Dr. Barry Marshall comes along. He's doing research that challenges this idea of ulcers being caused by acid, and he's discovered that it is bacteria. So he ended up getting a Nobel Prize in medicine for his discoveries. But did people believe him? No. I mean, it's just like, it's so interesting, and it took a long time. Because they, you know, people accepted, we found truth, it's acid. Yeah. And they started creating treatments to reduce the amount of acid, and that helped, but it was not a cure. Mm-hmm. And so it was, Marshall finally, to get, because he couldn't, I don't know, he was having trouble finding the right animal to do the research on, he used his own body. And he put the bacteria in his gut and got ulcers and then cured himself with antibiotics. And then people paid attention. But to me, it's a very interesting thing to think about in relation to science of mind. We are in the 100th anniversary of this philosophy, which seems like a long time, but in the past example of humans' ability to embrace a new way of thinking, that's a short amount of time. So I guess we shouldn't be so frustrated that this philosophy isn't more highly embraced than it is. And I believe that each generation has the greater capacity to embrace new ideas more easily, more quickly. And so, all right, so when we ask, what should we believe? You know, that's the question. And there's just this little sidebar. There's philosophers of science. It's Larry Lawden and Kyle Stanford. They came up with this idea. It's called pessimistic meta-induction, which means, because scientific theories in the past have always eventually been overturned, we ought to think that our theories now will probably be overturned as well. Yeah, and just, you know, not think of them as static truth that's set in stone. And there's a funny joke that says, science progresses funeral by funeral. Oh. So sometimes it takes, you know, a certain generation to move on before there's advancement. But they've also witnessed that young people will embrace new ideas more easily, and it's because they're not attached to the old ones. So that's encouraging. So if we think about scientific knowledge evolving and the truth that we find in scientific knowledge as changing and evolving, but you know, when we think of spiritual truth, we think of it as constant. And I think that still holds true, except that it's our experience and our understanding that evolves. And so as we are willing to believe something greater, as we are willing to trust a new way of thinking, then we have experiences that reinforce those beliefs. But does that mean that that's it? That we have landed on the final truth? That spiritual mind treatment, that's the only way to bring a change? I don't think so. I think they'll always be, well, even right now, you know, there's all kinds of different ways of using thought creatively. And so I think we will continue to evolve and find even newer and different ways as time goes on. And I think we're dealing with universal truths about the way the universe is set up, but we're revealing new ways to access that. So coming back to science, because I do believe science of mind is a science, if you think about some of the latest science, like quantum physics, which is stating that thought influences vibrational waves of energy that make up matter. One of the examples of that, to me, that really stood out, and this took place, I don't know, it could be almost 20 years ago now. You may remember Dr. Emoto. He was from Japan. He did these experiments with water. He had these water in clear glass containers, and he labeled these jugs of water. Are you all familiar with this? With like love. Well, like love and hate. You know, positive, what we would call divine qualities, and then the more undesirable qualities. And I went online and found some pictures of these crystals. There was a lot more pictures of the beautiful ones than the ugly ones. Which is nice. That's nice. But So I have one whole page of all beautiful crystals. I don't know how long this took, I think it was only like within 24 hours. It was a short amount of time. He took the water from these jugs and then froze it and examined the crystals that were created from the words. Now, if you think of, it could be, is it the vibration of just the word? You know, so should we be running around with tattoos of love on our bodies? I don't know, maybe. Or was it the people that saw that and had that feeling from the word, and that infused the water? I'm not really sure, but I'll pass these pictures around because they're pretty amazing. So the labels that were of what we would call positive, or I call divine qualities, the crystals are beautiful. The ones that were the undesirable qualities, the crystals are very chaotic, disorganized, nothing really attractive about them. So you wonder, what those kind of thoughts can do to our bodies, our lives, and why the positive thoughts are so much more life-affirming. So we keep asking, what are we willing to believe? And sometimes it's not easy to believe things that are new and unfamiliar. But what if we could at least suspend doubt and come to this new idea with curiosity? And that's kind of, you know, where I was when I first found Science of Mind, and when people were telling me that, you know, you can manifest things in your life. I had a curiosity. I was willing to experiment, and I think that's a good place to start. So if everything demonstrates from invisible principle, we're dealing with a creative process here, and it's an impersonal process. It creates based on what you're thinking. And so it's our responsibility to create a positive mental receptivity, as positive as we can, to be receptive, to be anticipating the good, anticipating what we want or something better. And so if we think of it as from a scientific kind of, from quantum physics, it's like putting a wave. This thought has a vibration, and it's putting a wave out into the universe. And we keep putting that wave out, and it's like Abraham said, when that wave gets enough momentum, then it has an impact on matter, and it shows up in physical form. And so being focused, it's not a hard thing. It's not like it shouldn't take a lot of effort. I think it's better when it's lighter. If you think about how do we create that fertile soil for our thoughts, to me it's relax. Because when we're stressed, it's like we're tight. We only get to see through that straw. You know, when we're stressed, our focus is it narrows. We activate that limbic part of the brain that's all about survival. It brings up fear. So stress is such a killer for creative receptivity. So how do you relax? Well, everybody probably has ways they relax that work really well. I think because I'm a yoga teacher and because I teach meditation classes to cancer patients, you know, that's a tough thing, a tough condition to have, because, you know, it's life-threatening. But I just witness change. I mean, people's faces change from before meditation to after meditation. I notice it most in the meditation class, because that's our focus, really, is to relax and use the breath. And so if you're curious, we're going to do that during the workshop, but if those that won't be joining us today on the recording, if you're curious about that, you know, there's all kinds of, I'm sure, articles out there about breath work. And the key, from my experience, is lengthening the exhalation. Because as you lengthen the exhalation, you're slowing the breath down. It activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which is that part of your body that brings, what I think, brings us back to our normal state of calm and peace. Now, I say normal state because I think that if all things were, if everything felt good, if every area of our life felt good, you know, then we could be in that state naturally, without consciously choosing it. But because we live in a world where there's so much going on and so many things that don't feel right, it's very easy to get stressed. And so breath work, because let me just go through that briefly. What the technique that I'll be using with you later. We start out just being aware of the breath. Then we go into balancing the breath. So the easiest way to do that is to counting on the inhale, counting on the exhale, making it the same number. I usually go with a 4-4 count. After you've balanced the breath, maybe 10 breaths, maybe 5 breaths. You know, it depends on what feels good to you. Then I shift to a 4-6 count. So you're lengthening the exhalation. And after that, you know, again, 5-10 breaths, whatever you for the before you make the next change, you want to be aware that you're very relaxed. So if you're really not relaxed yet, just keep going with the 4-6. The next pattern, you continue with the 4-6, but you add a pause. So you're waiting before you take your next inhalation. And that pause can be very brief. All of this conscious breathing should be real comfortable and easy. We're not forcing the breath. But if it's comfortable, and you can let that pause be longer, I have found such a sweet spot. It's kind of hard to describe, but I think it's because I've created in my body a stillness that's not natural. The body's always, we're always breathing in, breathing out. There's always that movement. It's always going on. And in that pause, there's no breathing. Our heart's still beating, everything's fine. And it feels very comfortable. You know, that's the surprise, I think, to a lot of people, is how comfortable that pause can be. It's like, I'm not breathing, but I'm not freaking out. You know, I mean, because normally, if we're not breathing, we go into panic. You know, I can't breathe. But you've prepared the body for that. The body's gotten so relaxed that pause, it's just so easy. And in that pause, I think it's such a deep state of relaxation that we've opened the potential of opening to this portal, this connection to however you understand your spiritual source. I think that's what happens because we're so relaxed. There's nothing in the way of receiving. So it's been a very powerful experience for me personally, and I witness it in my students. You know, that they're after class, their faces are just, they're just lighter. Yeah, it's very, very wonderful. So we will be doing some of that for the workshop. So meditation can certainly relax the body and the mind. And if you think about theta waves, you know, that's another frequency of vibration that's going out into the universe, which is the wave of meditation. But I don't think that meditation, you know, I know for some people that's challenging for whatever reason. They find meditation challenging. I don't think that's the only way you can relax. I think there's all kinds of ways. And one of the interesting ways is through creative expression. Brief story from the Brené Brown Wholehearted Living work. When she got to the creative expression, that's something that all the people in her research, everybody did some sort of creative expression. And she did none. So this was very uncomfortable for her. But what she found was it's an activity where you lose track of time. You know, you love what you're doing, or you just get so involved in it, you lose track of time, and you're enjoying it, and having fun. And so she did a little survey with her family. She's got two kids and a husband, and asked them to make a list of what things do they do that they really enjoy and they lose track of time. And then she looked, and then she created a chart. And she said there was four areas where her family all overlapped. And she said it totally changed the way they take vacations. Because in the past, they used to go to Disney World, and that was not on anybody's list. It was like swimming, fishing, hiking, and some game, Four Corners or something. Anybody know what that is? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Those were the four things that they all loved doing. And so their vacations turned into going down the road a few miles, renting a house on a lake where they could swim and fish, and there was hiking available, and whatever game, I think it's an outdoor game, but they could play in the yard. Wow. Yeah. I just thought that was brilliant. So entertainment is another way to relax. I mean, you all know how to relax. Everybody has ways they relax. So just being aware that consciously relaxing, choosing activities where you know you will relax. Okay. So coming back to Science of Mind being about experimentation and tying that into beliefs and how do we change beliefs? I have a couple stories from my own life. Early in my first marriage, I remember saying to my husband that I wasn't happy. And I was still coming from the perspective that, you know, everything out here is going to make me happy. I mean, I wasn't happy when we got married. I wasn't happy in my previous life, so why was I going to be happy in this life? But that was before I knew Science of Mind or any of that stuff. And what his response was, and he had studied a lot of psychology, and his response was, well, who do you know that's happily married? Or even happy? Who do you know that's even happy? And I thought, and I thought, and I thought. And I didn't really know anybody. I mean, even my parents, I felt like their marriage was more complacent than really happy. So that, there again, social networking and looking at what's around me and limiting, you know, just from my personal view of the people I knew, I came to the conclusion, okay, there's really not people that are happily married. Well, after my divorce, 17 years later, I met two couples that were happily married. I mean, really happily married. My good friend Linda, she would talk about Tom and she'd say that she fell in love with him all over again, periodically. Mm-hmm. And they just had a really, really wonderful life together. And my neighbors, Duard and Valerie, every anniversary, they would talk about what aspect of their marriage they were going to work on for the next year. And even say, do you still want to be married to me? You know, so there was this negotiation going on. And they were just the best of friends. So that shifted my belief because I witnessed it. So that is one way of shifting a belief, is to find what you like out in the world. I mean, I think I probably attracted that experience because I wanted that, you know, truly I wanted to believe that that was possible. Mm-hmm. And because I shifted that belief, I think I was able to manifest my current husband, Jim, who I am very happily married to. So yay!
Yay, Jim.
When I took the foundations class in Science of Mind, and this is when you learn spiritual mind treatment, Jim and I had been renting a house for like 2.5 years or so, and we were ready to buy a house. And so one of my first treatments was about a home. And I made a list within the treatment, you know, I want these features. And it was amazing because, you know, I wanted a reasonable price. We ended up with a private sale. Our realtor was very clever because he knew that, you know, he knew what we wanted, and he was interviewing for the position of being a realtor. He said, well, how about you give me the listing for one day? And I'll drop my, you know, my fee and all that, because he was pretty sure that this was going to be the house that we would get. And he was right. And so we ended up getting it below market. It had a lot of the features we wanted. It had a garage for Jim and space for small groups and, you know, just and close to a bus stop and, you know, all the things that I had on my list. So that really, I was impressed with that. And that was kind of an experiment. You know, I was in the state of, well, okay, I'm going to try this and see if it works. And it did. Then I want to finish with a story that I recently heard. Just somebody sent it to me just this week, and it's from Abraham Hicks' recording. And it was a story about Esther being at an airport, and she had held the. She probably does this every day. You know, she starts out the day with the intention of, you know, having a delightful day, and so she's at the airport and she sat down in a seat, and then. I don't know. She got up and down from her seat a number of times, but every time she sat in a different place. And, you know, she'd get a bottle of water, she'd go to the bathroom, whatever, you know, she was getting up three or four times and always sitting in a different place. Well, the last seat she sat in, she overheard somebody has their phone up to their ear listening to something. She recognized her voice, her own voice. So somebody's listening to an Abraham Hicks recording. And she looked at the person, and then she said, "That's me." "That's me that you're listening to." And the gentleman said, you know, he said, "Oh, I can't believe this. I can't believe this. I have to call my daughter, because she's the one that has me listening to this." And so he called his daughter, and she wasn't home, or she didn't pick up, but he left her a message, and then he hung up, and Esther said, "Let's call her again, and I'll leave her a message." And so they were just having so much fun with this. So she totally manifested this delightful experience. I mean, one experience, one encounter like that, that you're just going to have a great day. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to color your whole day. So I thought that was a great story. Okay, so in closing, let's realize that we have nothing to make, only reveal what's always available from the one life that lives within us. Holmes said that those who have the best success with plants love them. So if we transfer that, who has the best success in life? We need to love our lives, love our bodies, love our ideas. And be like scientists. Use spiritual mind treatment the way we use electricity. We have to apply it. Electricity has always been on this earth. But it wasn't until we learned how to apply it that it became such a powerful source that changed our lives. So know the words we speak. That they can destroy any man-made belief, they can destroy the thought of non-activity, annul the thought of lack, destroy the thought that time is not plenty. Holmes asks us, what are we willing to believe? How do we go beyond what has happened in the past? I hope that I've given you some ideas about that. And in closing, Jesus said, "The Spirit of Truth, when it comes to you, you will receive all things." Mm-hmm. The Spirit of Truth.
Could you say that again?
Sure. The Spirit of Truth, when it comes to you, you will receive all things. So we're in the process of opening to that Spirit of Truth. And that Spirit of Truth, I think it comes in waves of what we're ready to receive. If we receive a truth that's too big, we'll deny it. So I think truth is constant, but the way that it's revealed changes based on what we're willing to accept. And so it could be baby steps or it could be a quantum leap. But it is always available to us, that truth, if we relax and open to it. Thank you.
Wow. Yay.